You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, July 8th, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps and steps and steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, this is live to tape, as I say. We are on vacation this week, but we have all new content for you. It is unbelievable. Ladies and gentlemen, you can't believe this. On the program today, Greg Mitchell, from editor and publisher. He's an author of, I think, a dozen books. Author of The Beginning or the End, How Hollywood Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb. I'll talk about that more in a moment. Well, I mean, it's a fascinating story, and it's so important. And Greg Mitchell has been one of the few people, and he's written a couple of books over the years about Nagasaki and Hiroshima. We are now 75 years out. The bombs were dropped 75 years ago, August 6th and 8th, over the course of those 3 days, the two bombs, I believe, were dropped. And this country's understanding of what we did is so woefully ill-informed. And, you know, I think there are moments in history where you can say, had this happened and it was interpreted in that way or in a different way, or in really, frankly, in a truthful way, we may have had to change our behavior. It would change the course of history in many respects. And he tells the story of how we really, by we, I mean we as a country, really never fully, particularly in the moment, but that's also how, in many respects, how history is written. We're aware, appreciated, understood, A, the implications, B, the necessity or lack thereof, and the implications to human beings of dropping both those bombs. And there's a lot of narratives out there that exist about why we needed to do it and how we had no other options that are really not true. And Greg Mitchell tells this story via a fascinating sort of like side note of that history. In the wake of that history, there was an attempt to make a movie about that decision-making process and about the Manhattan Project. And if you don't know... Look, there's a lot of people who listen to this program who are younger than I. There's a lot of people who are younger than I in our society. But you may not know this history. And there are a lot of people my age and older who think they know this history but don't really know it. Greg has been on this program before, but many, many years ago, talking about another book, I think, that he did about the atomic bombs that we dropped. Enjoy, I guess. I don't know if I would say that. Remember that you can listen to the AM Quickie every day if you're missing sort of the news of the day. You can sign up for that at amquickie.com, or you can just search for it on iTunes or Stitcher or Spotify. I don't know if it's on Spotify. I think it's on Alexa. If you dare use that. And it may very well be on your Google Play or whatnot. So it's amquickie.com. You can sign up at amquickie.com as well. Check that out. It's also on the app at majorityapp.com. If you get the Majority Report app, which is free, of course, for iOS and for Android, you can it's on there every day, too. So you can get the news of the day. You can get it for the past couple of days. You can get it for the couple of days going forward as well this week, because we're not going to be live. So obviously you're not getting your daily news from us. But here's my prediction. Crap show. I'm recording this on Thursday of last week, and record-breaking infections in Florida. I think it was over 10,000. It's going to be more than that by this time next week. I would imagine it could be 15,000 a day by that time. It could conceivably be more. But remember, you know, when we say 10,000 today, what we're really talking about, people got infected about 2 or 3 weeks ago. So, and there's, you know, they're just starting to slow things down there now. So, amquickie.com. Also, one of the things I'm doing on my staycation is I am trying to just upgrade my situation. Part of that involves negotiations with my former wife, whatnot. But one of the things that are happening, that has been happening, is, you know, we have to sort of divvy up stuff like housewares and stuff like that. And for me, my secret in this whole process has been like, oh, I really like those really bad sheets. You can take them. You know, I pretend I like the sheets, but what I want to do is I want to replace everything with Brooklinen stuff. Because I got a couple of pairs of Brooklinen sheets, and they're fantastic. I want to get Brooklinen towels. I'm going to get Brooklinen bath rugs. What else they got? They have loungewear too. I'm not so much into that because I don't lounge. I'm just constantly working. But you may be aware that Brooklinen is the internet's favorite sheets, but they're also home to bedding. That's the other thing. I knew there was one other thing I was going to get. Bedding, loungewear, towels. They have over 50,000 five-star reviews and counting. They were the first, Brooklinen was, the first direct-to-consumer bedding company. They make all luxury products without the luxury markups. My Brooklinen sheets are awesome. And the pillows. I finally found a pillow that I like. I've got two king plush, hypoallergenic, of course, for me, pillows, and they're awesome. They've moved beyond the bedroom. They now offer bathroom and life essentials like towels and shower curtains, even ultra-soft loungewear that make you feel like you never left bed. You've got to check this stuff out. It's incredibly good quality at a very, very reasonable price. In fact, a low price for luxury stuff. My favorite is the classic cotton Brooklinen sheets, but the pillow is starting to like become my favorite thing in the world. I'm surprised I don't even bring it onto the show. I'm hanging on for dear life. Brooklinen.com is the perfect place to start making small changes that make big differences in your life. Brooklinen is so confident in their product that all their sheets, comforters, loungewear, I'm going to get a comforter, towels come with a lifetime warranty. So go on, make yourself comfortable, do it. Get 10% off your first order and free shipping when you use the promo code MAJORITY only at brooklinen.com. Brooklinen, everything you need to live your most comfortable life. Check it out. All right. Also, if you're starving for content, like I say, AM Quickie is there. You can become a member of the Majority Report. You can go back in our archives on our app. You can search all the archives. You can find all sorts of amazing stuff on there. Members are going to get a deep archive show either today or tomorrow or the next day or yesterday. And also, TMBS happened last night, the Michael Brooks Show. You can find that at patreon.com/TMBS or youtube.com/TMBS. You can also check out the Nomiki Show, patreon.com, the Nomiki Show. Also, youtube.com, the Nomiki Show. And the Antifada is happening. You can check that out, patreon.com, the Antifada. Jamie's and crew are doing multiple shows this week. And Jamie is also, I think she's going to be in, she's going to be in, on a panel on the virtual socialism conference. Oh, that was the other day. But you could probably go back and check that out too. And also, of course, Matt is on Twitch TV, twitch.tv, Literary Hangover. And so just search Literary Hangover on twitch.tv. Maybe it's twitch.tv/Literary Hangover. He's gaming and listening to books. Yeah, I know. Weird, but people love it. All right, quick break. When we come back, Greg Mitchell, the beginning or the end, how Hollywood learned to stop worrying and love the bomb. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program author of a dozen books, the former editor of Editor and Publisher magazine and a longtime blogger for The Nation. And on his most recent book, The Beginning or the End, How Hollywood and America Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb. Greg Mitchell, welcome back to the program.
Very happy to be here. Thank you.
So, Greg, we have spoken in the past. You have written multiple books from different angles about the dropping of two nuclear weapons on Japan. Let's just start with this: the beginning or the end. It was a film by MGM. Why tell this story?
Okay. Well, I should remind people this is the 75th anniversary of the event coming up, the movie to me encapsulated a lot of what was going on after after the war ended in terms of the what called the official narrative, which is that Truman had to drop the bomb; it was completely necessary. There really were no other options at that point, that it pretty much alone ended the war, and that, you know, Americans also had to get used to the, you know, to a new nuclear era with more and bigger bombs. And so to me, it's always been interesting as something of a media maven and historian, that whole post-war period for how this developed, how that narrative developed, and it really has carried through to this day, and I think that's what makes the book so relevant now, but also all the other the things that this narrative made possible, such as the hydrogen bomb and the arms race with the Soviets, which was so costly in so many ways. And you know, and again, people might say, well, why does this matter today? You know, this is 75 years ago, and there's nothing you can do about it. You know, not only can you not change the movie, but you can't change the fact of the dropping of the bombs and killing maybe 250,000 civilians. Nothing you really can do about that. But, you know, the fact is what has driven me for a couple decades or more, this is the third book I've written sort of on this subject, is that America today still has a first-use policy. Not many people really know that, but it is still official U.S. policy that we will launch nuclear weapons first, not necessarily in retaliation, but in response to a conventional attack, or even just the threat of a conventional attack, you know, from an Iran or North Korea or whoever. And, of course, Donald Trump is still in charge with the nuclear code. So, to me, this is not really a story about the past. It's really how this narrative of for Americans accepting, and the American media particularly accepting, the dropping of these bombs, how that influences attitudes towards you know, future use. And that's why it's so important to kind of study this and, you know, try to work our way out of that.
I want to get to some of the specifics. I mean, some of the sort of the narratives that were established in this film, or maybe were established before, and this film was seen as a vehicle to promote those. But let's just start with this for folks who are not as familiar with the history of the development of the bomb, and then we can lead into how this film got developed. But
right.
Just say a few words on the Manhattan Project so that folks understand, you know, sort of like what you know, the Manhattan Project itself, so that folks have an understanding of what the film was ostensibly retelling.
Okay, well, I'll do this incredibly briefly, I hope. Franklin Roosevelt launched and funded the Manhattan Project, a crash program to build the first, split the atom, build the first atomic bomb. We had heard that the Germans were at work at this, and that it was a race to beat the Germans. And this went on in 1943, 1944, 1945. Robert Oppenheimer was the famous scientific chief. Leslie Groves, General Leslie Groves, was the overall director and the military chief. And, you know, they did have their breakthrough, and they first tested the bomb 75 years ago this month out in New Mexico. But by then, the Germans had surrendered, and the whole drive to make the bomb and use it was the fear of the Germans. Of course, many of the Jewish and emigre scientists who worked on the Manhattan Project were very driven by combating the Nazis. So we tested the bomb successfully, and then the question was, well, would we use it against Japan? Japan did not have a nuclear program. There was no fear of that. Japan was
Greg, can you hold? Let me just stop you here. I just one question. So what was the broadly speaking, I can understand if you are under the impression that Germany is pursuing this weapon, that you want to get mm-hmm. there first. But what's the next part? Like, what's the end game? Or what was the thinking at that time? Germany is trying to get this weapon that is horrific. We need to get right. one, too, so that what? Like, what happens theoretically? And I'm talking, you know, in the early 40s, while they're contemplating why you do this. Like, what was,
right.
what, you know, like, as they did the steps out, right, as they sort of, like, gamed this out, how did they anticipate it would be used, or would it just simply its yeah. existence be a threat?
Well, certainly some of the scientists hoped it would just be a threat, and there was even a conversation between Roosevelt and Churchill, where Churchill said, you know, because the Brits were in on making the bomb, you know, and Roosevelt said, well, you know, maybe we'll just have to use it as a threat. But the fact is, you know, they anticipated using it against the Germans if necessary. Now, there is a whole school of thought that they never would have because the Germans were white, Western culture, and so on and so forth, where the Japanese, we had no qualms. So, you know, that is a possible factor. But, yes, the idea was to make it and possibly use it. You know, the idea of a threat could have also been used with the Japanese. But, you know, as you may know, we never explicitly warned the Japanese that we had this new weapon. We did demand that they surrender, but we did not say, we have a new weapon. You probably have heard about it, or you've heard about what an atomic weapon could do, and you better quit now. That never happened with the Japanese.
Well, in fact, the film sort of lies about that in some fashion, but we will get to that. So, all right. So I'm sorry. Continue. So the first test happens after right. the Germans have surrendered. Now, or I should not say now. Around now, 75 years ago. Then I'm sorry. Continue.
Well, okay. Well, then Truman, who had already sort of given the go ahead for the use of the bomb, which of course he could have rescinded, but you know they were on target to use it in early August at some point, and he was at Potsdam, and he was meeting with Stalin and so forth, and he was all energized because we'd had the successful test. Now the key, there's two key factors. Again, I can just say very briefly, which is not in the film, and again, this is a movie. To make clear, this is an MGM big budget movie. It's not a documentary, so we're talking about a MGM drama. But you know, Truman also knew at Potsdam that the Russians were going to finally declare war on the Japanese in early August, and you know, and Truman himself wrote in his diary, "Finny Japs," when that occurs. He felt that the Russian declaration of war and entry would produce a Japanese surrender. And he was aware of that. This is not something historians are, you know, looking back at, 75 years later. He wrote this himself in the diary. So he could have waited a short time to see what happens with the Russian invasion or declaration of war. The second factor was the Americans were still calling for unconditional surrender. And the Japanese, you know, rejected this, but there were many people close to Truman, including Stimson and John J. McCloy, you know, true hawks, who said, look, this is crazy. If we tell them, they can at least keep their emperor as a figurehead, that may very well produce surrender. And again, Truman did not do that. He still called for unconditional surrender. And then after the Japanese surrendered, we then let them keep the emperor. So
right.
Obviously, people look back and say, wouldn't some combination of the Russian declaration of war and letting Japan keep their emperor produce surrender in virtually the same time frame as as it did after the use of the bombs?
And the point of all that being is really to get to why use the bombs, right? I mean, there was I mean, and I think, you know, I'm not sure that folks, appreciate the latitude that the United States had at that moment in terms of a decision of making the bomb. And I think that's, you know, one of the things that I really appreciate about your work. So we'll tell more of that part of the story, I think, through the reshaping of the movie in some way.
Right.
So, all right, but tell us about how this movie is, they start production on this when? Like, it was a 1947 production, but that's usually just when they have finished. What was the genesis of this film, and when did it start?
Well, the genesis is kind of incredible. About 2 months after Hiroshima, the actress Donna Reed, who was a real favorite of mine as a youth, received a letter from her former high school chemistry student teacher back in Iowa, named Edward Tompkins, and he had disappeared. And she found out that the reason was he had been involved with this top secret Manhattan Project in Tennessee. So he wrote her a letter. This is, you know, again, two months or so after the bombing, begging her to get a movie studio to make a movie that would reflect the scientists' growing urgent views that, you know, we were about to embark on building bigger and more nuclear weapons. This was going to lead to a nuclear arms race. The history, the future of the world was imperiled. And it was a real stark warning. And of course, people like Einstein were involved in this himself. So it was a sort of begging her to get the studio interested in telling the story from the scientist's point of view, which was, you know, which was a important thing, obviously.
And it was a point of view. I mean, put a fine point on it. It was a point of view which I think reflected some measure. I don't know if regret is the right word, but I would imagine deep ambivalence at best as to their involvement in the project and where it has led. Because, like you say, a lot of these people got involved because they saw it as an existential threat that was coming from Germany.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of them didn't know this was even a munitions project. It was more of a beautiful, as Oppenheimer put it, scientific experiment. You know, split the atom, build a weapon. It actually works. You know, let's go home. But once it was used, and the way it was used, I mean, you know, it's a whole another, you know, half-hour discussion on why the Hiroshima and Nagasaki were targeted, why the bombs were dropped over the center of the cities, why the aim really was to kill civilians, and, you know, mission accomplished. So, you know, a lot of the scientists did have real qualms, and so they wanted to do something about it. They didn't want to just wring their hands. They wanted to, you know, stop future production of the weapon for military uses. So so they went to Donna Reed. Her husband happened to be an agent. He went to Louis B. Mayer, the head of the MGM studio. Mayer said, yes, we have to go ahead with this. It'll be the most important movie I ever make, big budget, et cetera, et cetera. And so they got a screenwriter and so on and so forth. So that process begins. Now, as a sidelight running story in the book is also kind of the amazing story that Paramount was also launched the similar project at the same time, and they hired Ayn Rand as the screenwriter. And she, most people don't even know she had been a screenwriter, but she had written screenplays in Hollywood for a few years. So she was hired to write the competing script. And there's a great deal in the book. I sort of was able to look it through all her outlines and drafts and letters and early scripts and everything. And so it's people will kind of have some horrible laughs over the direction she took the story, as you can imagine.
I can imagine.
Super pro-capitalist, pro-individual, scientists must not be restrained, et cetera, et cetera. So, so you had these two competing projects going at the same time. And ultimately, Paramount gave up and threw in with MGM. Ayn Rand was angry and went off to write Atlas Shrugged. That's another story. But anyway, so then MGM had a clear field. But what had happened was that they had the original scripts, and the whole direction was to express the scientists' warnings. But then they went to Truman and talked to him, and then they signed a contract with General Groves and gave him $10,000, which is the equivalent of $130,000 today, to be chief advisor. And Groves essentially got script approval.
So let me stop you
Groves
here.
Groves was a tremendous pro-bomb. He made fun of radiation effects. You know, he was like the worst person in the world you'd want to have more or less in charge of an MGM movie depicting the, you know, the making and use of the bomb.
I'm not convinced he's not one of the worst people you'd want in charge of anything. I mean, this guy, you know, honestly, like, you know, there's this, I'm sure he may have had more military acumen, but he sounds like, you know, like Seb Gorka. I mean, in today's parlance, honestly. I mean, but what? Tell me how we went from mayor and presumably he was sincere about this in terms of like presenting. I mean, because they must have known that this was going to be at odds, at least to some extent, with the military, right? I mean, to because they were expressly looking to promote or to tell the scientist's perspective, and mm-hmm. and so they must have been aware that their perspective was unique and probably one that you know, the military didn't necessarily want to highlight. I mean, right? I mean, because yep. Why else is there a story here? So how do they go from we're doing this, you know, tell this story for the scientists, which is one of like caution, and then go to Truman and go to Groves? I mean, what was that process? I mean, certainly Mayer knew. Right. I mean, MGM had been putting out propaganda films and they knew how this worked, didn't they?
Well, I think they knew how it worked. And of course, you have, you know, Mayer was a right wing Republican. So I think, you know, he liked the idea of making this movie, but he wanted to make money, you know, and he certainly didn't want to be at odds with the government and the military. So I think when he signed off on it and the early scripts were written, I think the feeling was, and it was rampant in our land, concerns about the future with the bomb. And so I think they thought there was room in a movie to express, you know, military pride and, you know, macho, let's move forward, with scientific caution. And indeed, it is possible. The early drift, the early scripts kind of did that. They weren't all just pro-scientist. But those early scripts, which were, you might call, balanced, then got completely turned in the other direction, one direction after, you know, Groves and Truman got involved. So, and MGM was, well, it's fine. This is the most Americans are certainly were supported the use of the bomb at that point. It was a popular view that we had used the bomb. You know, for box office, maybe we need to make a more, you know, more pro-bomb picture. And so I don't think they needed much urging to accept this, but they were over the barrel. Once they gave Groves script approval, they were kind of stuck with, you know, whatever he demanded. And he went a little further than they expected. But, you know, in a way, it's a Hollywood story. You know, the best intentions were led astray by you know, money and pressure from others. But this was, I should say, this was a very unusual to this point. There never had been a president who got so involved in a Hollywood movie, and there never had been a, you know, in a post-war, this was not the wartime censorship, you know, the military calling the shots on a movie like this. So it was very unusual, and it, you know, it makes for a kind of an exciting, dramatic story in the book, because it's you know, it's a kind of an incredible narrative as it moves along.
Now, so to what extent, from the perspective of, okay, so I understand, you know, Mayer's intentions and where it, you know, got sidetracked, and, you know, having spent some time in Hollywood in my youth, none of that sounds surprising at all. You start with this idea that we're going to have the top actors in the country, and by the end, you're getting, you know, sort of like the would be's, and in fact, that's how I got a lot of work when I was in Hollywood. But putting that aside, from the perspective of Truman, of Groves, of the military, broadly speaking, and I guess maybe it's really on some level it really is Groves. Was there a conscious plan or awareness or desire or understanding of the need to create a narrative that would make what we did less heinous?
Yeah. Well, you know, let's put in perspective, because this is in this period that the pressure they felt they were under to defend Truman's decision. Now, again, you got to remember, first of all, that we even though there was incredible carnage during the war, and a lot of people have excused the atomic bombings because of that, you know, these were two American acts. This is not like the Nazis and death camps. This is the Americans dropping two bombs over two cities and killing all these people. Now, this had been partly hidden to this point. You know, certainly we saw aerial photos of Hiroshima. There were reports that tens of thousands had died and so forth. So it was not like a secret, but the full extent was still not really known. There were no photos of victims or survivors. There was no real sense of the human effects. The number of fatalities were played down. The radiation effects were played down. So, you know, people had come to sort of accept that maybe this wasn't so terrible.
Now, as we're looking at the script, are we just about a year or so out? I mean, it's so hard, I think, for, you know, even myself, who grew up in a, you know, a largely, or for at least, you know, a significant, you know, portion of my adult life in a sort of pre-internet era, maybe, you know, but I think it's hard for people to understand how you could create that level of carnage and there being very little sort of like record or understanding of it, you know, contemporarily. Now,
right.
On the other hand, of course, you know, what did we see of Iraq after the, you know, the initial, you know, shock and awe and stuff like that? We, you know, as it ground out. But I mean, so, you know, there's at least an analog there that, you know, there's always an attempt by the U.S. government, and I would imagine all governments, to hide what war looks like. You know, at the very yeah. least, we know that Vietnam was in many respects impacted. You know, the American public's perception of Vietnam was impacted by the level of television coverage it got.
Right.
And so, you know, that's the thing I think I just, you know, people need to understand here, is that there was a huge vacuum. And did when Truman got...
Well, we had MacArthur. MacArthur had a... we had the U.S. occupation. MacArthur took over, and he had a censorship office in Tokyo. And even though the war was over, it was a wartime sort of censorship office. So all reports had to go through MacArthur's office, and whether they were the Japanese trying to tell their own story or American correspondents trying to who visited the cities, they had their stories subjected to censorship or even being killed, which was done in many cases. Photos were basically pretty much banned. There was no free, and I mean, there's a couple pages in this book about how the U.S. seized all the Japanese newsreel footage and color footage shot by the American military. I wrote another book on it called Atomic Cover-Up and actually just finished directing a film of the same name, all about the seizure of the most historic film footage, which then was locked up for decades. So you have to appreciate that this the full story had not been told. But then I should mention that right when the edits, the revisions of the MGM film were happening, lo and behold, John Hersey's article in The New Yorker came out. This was in August of 1946. And, of course, this has been called by some people the most famous or most important article of the century. And he actually, detailed the effect on survivors or the victims in Hiroshima and caused a national sensation. So in the fall of 1946, when this film was going through its final editing, there was finally a bit of a backlash in the U.S. About the use of the bomb. So things really came to a head here in the autumn of 1946. The film was not yet finished. And this was when, again, one of the major sections in the book is about how then Truman ordered a retake of the key scene that featured him in the movie, in which he sort of explains the decision to use the bomb. He not only ordered and got this retake, but he also got the actor playing him fired. So, this is all in this post-John Hersey atmosphere leading up to the actual release of the movie.
So there, I mean, to the extent that we can tell, there became a greater urgency to promote this narrative.
Absolutely.
That, as time went on over the course of this. All right. So outline for us like some of the and people should also, it's also hard to appreciate this, like, an MGM movie, from the perspective of people in 1947, this thing could be the defining narrative for history on some level, right? I mean, that's the thing. It's hard to, I think, to appreciate today, like, oh, a movie. Well, there's 5,000, a million of them that are being produced and we're going to see on it. But that's not the way it was then. A movie was a major, major, major event. And I would imagine from the perspective of Truman and Groves and also from those scientists, there was a real sense that this was that this is something that we would be in our consciousness for decades. This film, the story it tells, and so talk about the myths that were spread into the film that I think really do show, one, what the U.S. government was worried about, what Truman was worried about, and what Groves was worried about in terms of the way that we would be perceived, and particularly the way that we were perceived in terms of, like, was this really necessary?
Right. I mean, there are many, 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 I mean, some are you might call it details. Others were key parts of the narrative. But just to give you on the detail and how far it went, we needed to show that our attack on the two cities was risky, brave, usual American gung-ho, proud aviator kind of thing. So they, again, thanks to Groves and so forth, they injected into the script the bombers heading for Hiroshima were hit by anti-aircraft fire and flak, and then in a later script it became heavy flak, and then in a later script it became Japanese fighters nearby about to maybe fire on them and shoot them down. this was all complete myth. None of that happened. We had clear sailing into Hiroshima, so that was all made up. They also made up that we dropped millions of leaflets over Hiroshima, warning them that the atomic bomb was coming. And again, no such thing happened. So just in those,
I want to be explicit on that, because I think that, like, you know, that is really revealing on some level. We put leaflets not before Hiroshima. We sent leaflets after Hiroshima, right? And then to Nagasaki. Is that right?
We dropped leaflets calling general calls for surrender. You should make your government surrender, and, you know, bad things are coming, that kind of thing.
Okay.
After Hiroshima, they prepared all millions of leaflets to drop, and in fact, they did drop them over Nagasaki, but it was the day after Nagasaki was bombed. So that also is obscured. But in the film, you know, again, so I go through these many details, you know, there are really too many to go into here, but it's revealing what also was omitted, maybe even more important. For example, how revealing is it that the final movie, final cut of the movie, deleted any mention of Nagasaki? You could watch this movie and never know there was a second bomb. It was all the early scripts. There was plenty of Nagasaki. Now, what's the reason for that? Well, Nagasaki is even more questionably morally than Hiroshima. And I go into it in the book, and, you know, and so on and so forth. It just was, you know, the second bomb, even by people who thoroughly endorse the use against Hiroshima, are sort of sickened by the use against Nagasaki. So, Nagasaki raised too many questions, so they had to get rid of Nagasaki completely.
How many thousands of people? Tens of thousands were killed in Nagasaki.
Probably about 100,000, and Hiroshima was 150,000. So, and in Nagasaki, I mean, Hiroshima was about 80% civilians, women, mainly women and children. Nagasaki, it was like 98%. Nagasaki did not have a major military base of any kind. It's been estimated that maybe 100 military personnel were killed in Nagasaki, and actually there were about several Dutch POWs that were killed in Nagasaki. But so Nagasaki was wiped out of it, and of course the film, again, in the editing, omitted any mention of the Russians entering, mention of this idea of keeping the emperor, anything that complicated. And then, of course, it also built up the number of fatalities that were expected if there was a U.S. invasion. And this, you know, this again, this has been debated for decades now, but you know, they were claiming millions of American lives would be lost in an invasion, which, you know, is complete nonsense, especially with the weakened position of Japan. And the invasion wasn't even scheduled till November, starting in November, and then the second leg was early in 46. So it wasn't like they were on the verge of launching this D-Day type invasion of Japan. It was many months off, and
right.
So it adds to the feeling of many that Truman could have taken a few days or, you know, a couple weeks or something to reconsider using the bomb against two cities.
And there's a scene in the movie about that implies that the Germans were, you know, there was bomb technology that was getting rushed to Japan at that point as well, right? And
well, I'll give Groves a little credit there. It was even too much for him. There are mentions. They kept adding to the script mentions. FDR mentions it. Groves mentions it in the scripts that the Japanese might have atomic weapons. You know, our invaders might be met by atomic weapons from the Japanese, which again was complete nonsense. But the key scene that did get omitted was they actually had the Germans arriving in a cove near Tokyo to deliver nuclear technology to the Japanese, which would allow them to quickly build a bomb and, you know, defeat the Americans. And, of course, the kicker was that the Hiroshima lab, or the Japanese lab, was in Hiroshima. So, I mean, it shows you how far they went to justify. I mean, if you can imagine that they, Hiroshima had to be bombed because they were building atomic weapons there that were going to be used against the Americans. So that shows how desperate they were. But, you know, you have to say that it showed incredible desperation and defensiveness. But, you know, they carried it off. And, you know, again, the point of the book and the relevance for today is that, you know, 75 years later, basically polls show most Americans still endorse the use of the bomb against Japan. The media overwhelmingly endorses it. We've just seen the recent example of Chris Wallace's book, The Fox Personality. His book has become a number two bestseller about the bombing, which endorses the bombing. You know, every year, you know, the media, you know, tends to endorse the use of the bomb, and to this date, the only president who has said anything critical about it is Eisenhower, who actually opposed the use of the bomb before it was used, and then criticized it, later. And the only other president worth mentioning is Obama, who was the first president to ever visit Hiroshima and Nagasaki while in office, which he didn't say anything critical of the bombing, but it took 70 years for any U.S. president to even visit Hiroshima or Nagasaki.
Greg, lastly, let me ask you this: in the course of all the research you've done around this, did you ever find like where Groves or Truman or anybody involved in that chain of command, expressed some type of regret? Like, I'm curious,
Certainly not Groves. And Groves, and really Truman didn't either. We found, I did a book with Robert J. Lifton a few years ago in which he sort of analyzed Truman and found a couple glimmers of regret. But Truman, famously said till the end of his life, he never lost any sleep over it. The key scene that he had this costly retake ordered, that Truman himself ordered from the White House, basically involved showing that he pondered this decision, he agonized over it, he talked to everyone over and over about it, very deliberate, to show he did this all with a heavy heart and so on and so forth. But he was once asked, how long it took him to make this decision, and he snapped his fingers to show how quickly he made the decision. So, that's where the revisions and retakes in the movie are so revealing, that they wanted to express a certain view that would last, and it has.
Yeah, it really has.
Frighteningly, well, to this day, it has lasted. In a way, they pulled it off.
Well, Greg, I'll tell you, that's frankly why, I have such appreciation for the work that you've done in this book and the others, is because I think that's a narrative that I think most people just accept and have never questioned, and there really is not as much of an opportunity to question that narrative as there should be. The book is The Beginning or the End: How Hollywood and America Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb. We should also say, just as a coda, the film did not do very well, and by that point, it wasn't going to achieve its, at least the mission of those scientists who had sort of initiated the thing. Greg Mitchell, we will put a link at majority.fm to the book. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Sam, it's always a pleasure. Thank you.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in. And my pilot light shining bright. I guess somewhere the choice is made for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that it finally breaks you. I guess I might have lost my drive between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you? Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gone.